We never let go of anything that was really, that played well and that people came to really want. The Sea Psy routine, we ran for 25 years or more. That came about just accidentally. My partner and I were working on that part of the show, and we're doing a satire on the treasure of Sierra Madre, a new picture that just came out. It was 1949. And we're down in Mexico on this gold hunt for gold with Jack, Don Wilson. Jack would play the Humphrey Bogart part. Forget what Don was, but Walter, you, whatever. And we come to this Mexican, we start asking these questions, and every answer was, Siri, what's your name? Sai, Siri. That was the first routine, and that's all we did with it. But from that time on, we played with it, and for 25 years, we elaborated on it, and built it, and it became a kind of a masterpiece. I'm going to jump right now to the very end because it's getting long for you. Another thing that happened more or less accidentally, which became a big thing, was, do you remember the I Can't Stand Jack Benny contest? We're sitting in a room one day in Jack's home in Beverly Hills, and we don't have an idea for a show the next week. And we, at that point, don't know what to do. Sunday's coming, every minute's getting closer, and we have nothing on paper. And somebody said, Jack, couldn't we get an idea for some kind of a contest of music where we ask the listeners to write lyrics and they send them in, and we'll have our musical director, Malin Merrick, set it to music, and we'll have a contest and so forth and pick a winner. And Jack says, no, I don't want to do it like that. So there's silence, and I said, Jack, I got an idea. You constantly hear, every 5 minutes on the radio, write in 25 words or less why you like Acme toothpaste, why you like this, why you like, everything is like. I said, why don't we have a contest where we ask people to write in 25 words or less saying why they can't stand Jack Benny. You never heard such silence. Everybody looks at me. I look back at them. Jack doesn't say anything. I figured, well, that blew the whole thing. Silence continues. And he gets up. He walks across the room, put his hand on my shoulder. He says, that's it. We said, Jack, what are you? He says, that's it. That's what we're going to do. We're going to ask people to write in, only we'll give them 50 words to tell why they can't stand me. So we said, gee, Jack, that's kind of... He says, no, don't worry about it. We'll get a lot of comedy out of that. And we did. We were trying to get a show out of that meeting, trying to get one show. We came up with the I Can't Stand Jack Benny contest. It ran for 11 weeks. Now, what we did, to sum it all up very quickly if possible, what we did was we had the idea originate with a publicity man who came in and said, Benny, we got a great idea for you, so-and-so. He said, well, Steve, what are you? He said, we're going to ask people all over to write in why they can't stand you. He said, Steve, are you crazy? He says, no, letters come in by the millions. So forth. Jack decides to go for it. This is on the air, you see, that was our premise. So the final word of his agreeing to do it was, I ought to have my head examined. So now we start the contest. Following week, we had a teaser. Listen in next week for the start of the contest, etc. And then the second week,
We really started it and asking people, and Jack gave away $10,000. He gave away in victory bonds. He said the first prize was $5,000, second prize was whatever, third prize. And the mail came pouring in. And not strangely, every letter except for a tiny small percentage was exactly in the spirit that we expected. It was people who entered into the fun of the contest. We hired 8 girls who did nothing but open mail bags and sort the mail. They were on for weeks. And they got it down to where there was a relatively few to be considered. And we'd already said on the air that Fred Allen was to be the final judge. During that time is when we did what I think is one of the classiest shows that we ever did and perhaps has ever been done on radio, I think. It was the first show that we did with the Ronald Colemans. Again, they were to come on for one appearance and they went into 4 or 5 years. It was an idea, we won't play the show, I wish we had time, but I won't play it, where Jack threw a mix-up in the mail. An invitation was blown out the Ronald Holman's window across the hedge to Jack's back porch, and he found the note says, "Dear Jack, expecting you for dinner on such and such a night," so forth and so on. He bawled out Rochester for being so careless with his mail and stuff. Now, Jack... We go to the Coleman's house and we find out where Benita is saying, "Ronnie, did you see where that note that I wrote for Jack Wellington, who was visiting from London, to come to dinner and so forth?" He says, "Well, no, I guess it must have blown out the window." So they called Wellington instead. So that took care of that. Now Jack is home getting dressed in top hat, white tie and tails to go to a party, to a dinner where he's not even invited. This is our premise. In the meantime, Jack Wellington arrived at the Coleman's house, and they're just sitting around relaxing, and he had come from the tennis courts. So he said, "Shall I go dress?" They says, no, just stay in your slacks and sweater. We like to relax this way." Now Jack's coming in top hat, white tie and tail. So I could have played it for you instead of telling you. Well, anyway, Jack came in. Well, we had just tremendous fun. And before Jack came in, we set up that animosity because we talked about Benny and the I Can't Stand Jack Benny contest. And Wellington began saying such rude things about Jack. All these things he couldn't stand about him. And Ronnie says, "You know, don't waste it. Write it down, you know." So now Jack comes in and it was a miserable evening. And he, when he first comes in, he sits down. And after he talks a little bit, he says, "Well, I'll just sit here while you folks run up and get dressed." So anyway, we finished that show. And then... by this time, the contest finished. And we're now ready for Fred Allen to read the winner. We're ready, but the tape isn't.
"This is Fred Allen in New York. But I know you've all been waiting for the winners of the I Can't Stand Jack Benny contest. So here they are. The first prize, wake up, Mr. Benny, this isn't a dream now. The first prize, $2,500 in victory bonds, goes to Mr. Carol P. Craig, Sr., 735 Radcliffe Avenue, Pacific Palisades, California. The second prize, $1,500 in victory bonds, goes to Mr. Charles S. Dougherty, Hotel Bolton Square, Cleveland 6, Ohio. The third prize, a $1,000 victory bond, goes to Miss Joyce O'Hara, 1014 Dragoon Avenue, Detroit 9, Michigan. The additional 50 winners of the $100 bond will be notified by telegram, and the bond sent registered mail. P.S. If Mr. Benny should deliver any of these telegrams personally, please tip him generously, ladies and gentlemen. He's been through a terrible ordeal, I am happy to say. Good night, folks. Father's not.
All right, now, that announced the winners. Now, the next week, which became the 11th week, we wanted to read the winning letter on the air. So, we had to find a device to do it, and this is what we did. We had a premise where the Colemans and Jack were going to a concert or theater or someplace, and when the evening was over, they came out to the check stand, and Ronnie's coat and Jack's coat got mixed up. And this is what happens when the Colemans get home.
Money
belt.
Maybe.
Well, all right. Now that I gotta back that up.
Team Dragoon Avenue, Detroit 9, Michigan. The additional 50 winners of the $100 bond will be notified by telegram, and the bond sent registered mail. P.S. If Mr. Benny should deliver any of these telegrams personally, please tip him generously.
Oh, I see. All right, now. Yeah, I want to. Yeah, that's just. I know that's a repeat.
I am happy to say. Good night, folks. Father's mother.
All right, fine. Now, that was the end of the Fred Allen part. I thought I had the wrong tape on there. Yeah. All right, now that's the end of the show in which we announced who the winners were. This is the next week now where we want to read them.
I think that's one of the finest concerts I have ever heard.
Here we go.
Absolutely wonderful.
Give me a cigarette,
will you?
Of course I have some right here in my room. I have some, and I say this is my coat. There must be a mix-up. Look.
You sure?
Yes, I'm positive I have. Definitely look at the label. Why, this is Jack Benny's.
Jack Benny?
Yes.
Oh, well, tomorrow doesn't have to. A woman. What are you looking at?
Huh? Oh, it's the dress book I found in Benny's stuff.
A dress book?
Yes. You know, he's always boasting about his influential friends. Well, listen to this first name. Man, Zibisco, Madison 0338.
That is
the disco. There's a note written alongside the name. It says, do not kiss too hard, have pivot to. And listen to his nickname, Marcello T. And then he has in parentheses, approach from the right, she's left-handed.
Oh, yes, that seems to be friends. Oh, what's that? Folded sheet of paper just fell on the floor.
Well, oh, please look. It's one of his contest letters.
Oh, you mean the Ice Round Stand Jack Benny contest?
Yes. There's a little notation on it that says, this letter was written by Carol T. Craig Sr. and won first prize.
First prize! Oh, golly, I wonder what the winning letter was like. Read it, please.
Uh-huh. It says, I can't stand Jack Benny because he fills the air with boasts and brags and obsolete, obnoxious gags. The way he plays his violin is music's most obnoxious tip. His cowardice alone, indeed, is matched by his obnoxious greed. And all the things that he portrays show up my own obnoxious way. Now, you don't believe me, that's very clever.
Yes, there's a good thought behind it.
Yes. And all the things that he portrays show up my own obnoxious way. You know, Benita, Maybe the fellow that wrote this letter is right. The things that we find fault with in others are the same things that we tolerate in ourselves.
That's so true, Ronnie.
It certainly is.
That about sums it up, I guess. Pardon me. Thanks so much for having me here.
We want to thank you for spending the afternoon with us and telling us about the Golden Age of Radio that you had a part in. And we'd like to, it's my pleasure, as this is my first time to give an honorary membership as president to George Balzer for his recognition of his great and varied contributions he's made in the field of broadcasting during the Golden Age of Radio. You are now an honorary member of Spurtback.
Marvelous. I appreciate that very much. I hope my stumbling along here didn't get too confusing. I tried to keep a little looser than usual, and I didn't want to take up 4 days. And yet, we, as much as you heard, and I think enjoyed, there's just an unlimited supply of stories and routines and explanations and so forth and so on that to do as much as we did.
I'm back.
I wouldn't mind coming back and talking to you. We had no time to we had no time. We had no time for many of you for any questions, but if there is anyone who does have a question or wants to know something, I'd be delighted to make an effort to answer for you. I want to tell you a true story. Perhaps I shouldn't. But maybe it will say something. I don't know. You all watch television, and I think television is great. They do great news. Sometimes they can't. They try too hard to be first and broadcast wrong things, which I think is a... I think the public has a right to know. There's no question about it. But I don't think the public has to know almost before it happens. I just don't think it's that necessary to be that fast. And that's why, with the events of the last week, so many mistakes were made. They couldn't wait to give you information that they didn't even know was right. So there's not that hurry to do it. But I think news is great. Documentary is great. On-the-spot broadcast, great. Sports, marvelous. Many entertainment shows are great. But I really think there are too many of them that aren't. You asked me if I'm writing now. Yes and no. I've been kind of, with my training on the Benny Show, or my, the atmosphere in which I worked, or in which we were all asked to work, was so pleasant and so wonderful that when it was over, to now go into a lion's den of panic. And I tell you, this is what goes through. This is what happens. am I writing now? About a year ago, I did a show. And strangely enough, the other day or a week or two or three or whatever it was ago, I figured, what am I waiting for? Why don't I just retire, which I have been anyway, call up the guild and say, let's start the pension, and I'll forget it. The girl said, let me get your file. She got it out, looked at it. She says, Mr. Balzer, I think she called, I'm not sure. She says, you can't retire. I said, why not? She says, you've got 19 qualified years. Now, 19 qualified years means only this, that in the guild, when you have 20 qualified years, you are now, it has nothing to do with your retirement, but you're now eligible for lifetime insurance for you and your wife. From now on, they pick up the bill, pay it, the whole thing. And it's a tremendous policy. So she says, you can't retire. You've got to get one more qualified year. In order to get one more qualified year, that doesn't mean work a year. That means, you, in my case, if I do half an assignment, it's equivalent money-wise to what they require for a year. If I needed 18, if I needed two qualified years, I would have to work a little this year and then whatever, then work a little the next year to get the 2 years. So the point I'm trying to make, you asked me if I'm working now, I realize that I do now want to work because I want to pick up that little tiny bit that gives me that extra year. Which, incidentally, the 19 doesn't mean I've only had 19 years. I was in the business 10, 12 years before the plan ever started, and I got out early before it had gone too long. But nevertheless, I still have 19 qualified years. So I want to fill it out to 20, and I'll use a phrase, which you'll understand. I think the Benny Show and the Benny material, our approach to comedy, our understanding of what's funny and what isn't, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm talking now about the older writers. With all that, and I say this honestly, I will somewhere, I'm sure, but to just talk about it on the surface, I can't get a job. It's strange because it's not that they mean to be that way, but I walk into a producer's office now, and I will exaggerate to make my point. I can understand when I come in, and I say, I'm George Balzer. I understand when he says yes. Tell me about yourself. That's understandable. That's very understandable because how does he know? Not that there's anything to know, but if there were, how does he know? But when they almost say, who was Jack Benny? Now you know what is going on. I don't know whether the lad who was asking is 14 or 15, but he's producing a show, you know. It's a matter of time has gone on. I could be very wrong. I'm going to say things, I guess, which I shouldn't say, but the great miracle of the laugh machine has stunted the growth of talented writers. When we were in the business, there was no laugh machine. You wrote your material, and you worked on it, and you polished it, and you fixed it, and you rehearsed it, and on Sunday evening, you stepped up to that microphone, and at 7 o'clock, they threw the cue and you went on the air. Now it's too late. You're coast to coast. If you do material that doesn't get a laugh, That's just too bad. But we were lucky. We're lucky because most of the things we did. God laughs. I can honestly say, and if you'll forgive me for saying it, I really don't think in 25 years that Jack Benny ever did a bad show. We've done shows that weren't too good. We did shows that were just good. We did shows that were excellent. And we did a couple that were sensational. But the secret of the Benny Show was we were smart enough to know when to leave a script alone. When the four writers and Jack finished working on a script, and sometimes, although we worked week to week, sometimes we would finish that script maybe a day early. We had enough sense to put it down and don't touch it. We agreed it was right. Why do you now say, oh, it's only Thursday, let's start going over it? And we knew when it was right, or at least to the extent that you can know when it's right. And we knew that if you start picking, before you know it, you destroy what was very acceptable or perhaps good or maybe excellent. What happens today now? You bring in a script. You have no contact with the people who do the show. No contact. Goes through the producers and the staff writers, and it goes on stage, and when it once gets on stage, it goes through a process which I call, wouldn't it be funnier if? And you've got Second Bananas on stage doing the show, and one of them says, wait a minute, wouldn't it be funnier if I said so and so and so and so and so and so. Now the other actor or actress doesn't want to disagree because this 22-year-old is now the star. So he says yes. Well, they changed the line. Well, now because they changed the line, it doesn't just change one line, it destroys the next six pages. They don't know. Don't quote me, but these are just my analysis of the situation. It's a whole different business. Again, you go back, and yet I've been on shows where variety show for a full hour, staff of young writers, and I didn't mean to be critical, but I was unhappy with the script and with the producers and all. I will say, I don't think we got anything into the script. And we're sitting there one day, just before a rehearsal, where a reading, that is, where the whole cast and everyone's coming in just for the reading around the table. And I leaned over to one of the younger writers and I said, I'll bet you $1,000 there's not one laugh in this whole script. And of course he got a little upset with me and let me know it. And I said, well, I know how you feel, but that's just my opinion. Now let's just see what happens. Well, I lucked it out because when they read for 1 hour, there was not a laugh around that table. Not a laugh. I was no genius to know that. There was just a certain thing about dialogue with rhythm, pace, the way to say something, the pause, the look, whatever it might be. That's what makes it funny. So, am I working now? No, I'm not working. Yes,
How did the idea come about for the writing of Jack's song in the picture?
The writing of Jack's song. When you say I beg your pardon, then I'll come back to you. When the swallows something, what is it, the Capistrano? I've got that somewhere. How'd that come about? Jack came in one day and said, "Fellas, I got an idea. What if, in fact, I've already started to work on it. I write a song, and then I'll just try to get it published, and we'll have some fun with that, and we'll have guest stars trying to get them to sing it, and so on. Yeah, sounds like a pretty funny idea." So we developed it a little further. In the meantime, he wrote the lyrics, and Jack wrote those lyrics. Yeah. And Malin Merrick did the music. And this, see, you should never ask me a question. Never ask me a question. This brings up a story. Jack's song, "When you say I beg your pardon, then I'll come back to you. When you ask me to forgive you, I'll return. Like the swallows at Serrano come back from Capistrano. Something, 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 forever yearn." All right. Now that song, every time it was done, legitimately, I mean with the lyrics, the music, and a legitimate group or singers or what, always sounds so bad that we got a lot of comedy out of it. Now we went to Palm Springs and we got a great idea. Let's have the Guadalajara Trio, who they were going to do the music that week on the show. So we said, as long as they're going to do a number, let's have them do Jack's song. And they did Jack's song. I'll tell you, you've never heard a more beautiful piece of music and lyrics in Spanish. In Spanish, it was so good that we couldn't use it. We said, we can't make fun of that. It was a tremendous surprise. And we said, well, we just can't have them do it, because you can't knock what turns out to be so beautiful. And it was just great. So, like, does that answer the song? Yeah, that came from Jack. Jack wrote the lyrics, yeah. Yes.
We took all the Jack Benny shows that we made.
Yes.
On radio.
Yes.
Tried them end to end. Tell how many hours it was.
Well, let's figure it out now. 50, well, let's see. The Jack Benny show ran, it was a half-hour show every week. Ran for 35 weeks each year. When I first joined Jack, we did 35 weeks, and then I was on vacation for 17 weeks every year. But I was very young. Now that I've gotten older, I realize that I was not on vacation. I was out of work. So it does make a difference. But in answer to your question, well, you could figure that out with a little pencil and paper. A half hour, did you say how many miles? I was going to say, because we're getting into gasoline and everything there. How many hours? Well, the radio career started in 1932, and it ran until 1954. So you've got, 22 years there. And you run 17 hours a year. 17 a year. Well, I have every at home in my I would like to say in my library, but I don't have a library. I've got a little home office. On the shelves, I have every script that I have ever written, worked on, all bound. And I don't know how many volumes, but they're taking up too much room now.
We'd be glad to store them for you.
And, well, I'm thinking about at some time sending them back to, perhaps back to Notre Dame University. You know, I've kind of forgotten. I've read Milt's book, and I'm a very good friend of Milt. In fact, I met him. I was had lunch with him just the other day. I kind of forgot what he said about me. No, it doesn't ring a bell. Give me that again. Yeah, I remember that incident to some degree, but it was nothing major. But yeah, that's true. Oh no, no, no! You know, the four of us work together, and we work very well. When I say four, now I'm talking about Sam Perrin and Milton Tack. We didn't always agree on an idea, but somehow or other you could change it around and work it so that eventually you would all agree. And I had an idea once for television, which I could not get the others to agree. But then eventually I found a way. Now the idea, and it's pictorial, it was for television, where we were doing an operating scene in a hospital. We did it where Jack was cleaning out the attic with Rochester or something, and Roch came across a certificate that said that Jack had graduated from medical school, and boss, I didn't know that. He says, sure. In fact, if I weren't the world's greatest violinist, I could have been the world's greatest surgeon. So from this we, then Roch says, world's greatest surgeon, world's greatest surgeon, world's greatest surgeon. And we dissolve, we go to a hospital operating room, and now Jack is this great surgeon. We've got the patient on the table, and Mel Blanc is the assistant, German assistant, and they're working. Now, what we do is at the head of the patient is the old-fashioned, which they don't use anymore, but the balloon-type thing that represents the breathing of the patient. And we focus the audience's attention on that by doing a little bit, and he would say, nurse, halt. She would say 64 respiration, and she would look right at this balloon going. So we knew what that was. That was the patient taking in air and expelling air. So I came in one morning and said, fellas, I got a funny idea for a scene, I think, and I described this to them. No, we don't do that. I said, okay. So we spent a couple of hours, got a different idea, and did it. 4 or 5 weeks later, we're now stuck for another ride. I said, fellas, how about the balloon, the respirator bit? And I say, no. Spend another couple of hours, get a different idea. Very good. Did it. So it happened about 4, 5, 6 times. Can't sell the idea. I said, why? That's not funny. Okay. Now we go to New York. We do a show out of New York. The next day, we're going to fly out in the evening to come back to the coast. But in order to get a jump on the next week's show, we figure we'll stay in the hotel room, try to get an idea for the show, to be that much ahead. So we're sitting around the hotel, beautiful day, and nothing's happening. Can't get a thought. And I look out the window, and it's beautiful. I said, fellas, how would you like to go shopping? Walk down the street, spend some time in the park, so forth and so on. He said, yeah, we've got to get an idea. I said, we got an idea. We'll do the thing with the shh. Before I could do this, they were all out of the room. They were gone. That was it. They, okay, what should we do? So they bought the idea, and we went on the air. We wrote the show, went on the air, or on the television. And in order to do it, we had it all planted. We'd look over respiration. Now, here's what happened. Those of you who perhaps no one saw it, but we've got this breathing apparatus going. Go shh. Now, at a point, now, from this time on, we never look at it again. We looked at it before to plant what it was, but when it started to get bigger, we never looked again. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And Jack is picking it up, and he's under here. He's worked. Nurse, where are you? And she says, I'm over here. And we did that to the end. When we got through, we filled that whole sound stage, that is the set, with this big balloon. We had to get 3 Air Force weather balloons, and we kept changing them. We were filming so we didn't have to do it continuous. We'd get it so big, then we would bring in a real big one and hook it up. Then we'd bring in the tremendous and get everybody under it. And then at the end, while we cut out to the corridor, and we could still hear the shh, so we know what's going on, and all of a sudden, boom! And pictures fall off the wall, plaster comes down, Jack and Mel come staggering out, and Mel congratulates Jack because he's the first surgeon to ever blow out a man's appendix. That was the finish of the show. I only tell you that to say that we didn't always agree, but I think we were probably as close to always agreeing as any team ever was that I know of. There's always a little, I don't want to say infighting, but on so many staffs. See, all you have to do, if we're working together and I'm not too sharp, and I know in an hour we've got to finish this, I've only got an hour's time. Now, if you did all the stuff in the hour, I'm dead, especially if I'm being graded or watched. But if I kind of discourage what you say, that keeps us unfinished until I get a chance to think of something. See? And instead of working together, that goes on too much, or did at one time. Our attitude and my attitude really was if we had an assignment that should take an hour or an hour and a half or 3 pages or 5 pages, if you come up with 20 things that fill 4.5 pages, I've only got about 1/2 a page. Or if it's my day to be hot and things are coming and you take the same attitude, you've only got to write 1/2 a page. But if we work against one another, then it's tough for both of us, and you both got to write the full 5 pages.
Well, obviously it all paid off during those years. And we must invite you to come back and talk some more. Yes, that's it.
I'll be ready to go.
I'm trying to answer that with an explanation, but the answer is yes. He not only played the violin, but to sound the way he did, he had to make it sound that way, because he played a pretty fair violin. So much so, I don't know whether you're familiar with his concert tours or not. Tremendous success. He raised millions of dollars for concert orchestras all over the country. And the way he did it was that they would put on these very high society, fancy concerts with symphony orchestras, and they would sell seats for a lot of money, $100, $200, all for charity, for the charity to save the symphonies. And for 1 hour or more, when you attended one of those concerts, you listened, perhaps for the first time in your life, to good music. You would never have gone if Jack wasn't going to come on. So now people are sitting there and they're beginning to realize that that kind of music has a tremendous value and that they enjoy it. So that did something very needed. Then in the second half, as the guest soloist, would come Jack. And he had an opening joke, or rather an opening bit, which was so good. Came out when he was introduced with his white tie and tails and the violin. Came out, came to the center of the stage and took tremendous bows. Just everybody's applauding and waiting, and then things quiet down. And he's standing there, and he looks over to the conductor and nods. The conductor nods back. The music starts. And then Jack goes, and for the first time, he realizes he forgot his bow. He doesn't say a word. He walks all the way across the stage, goes into the wings, comes back, and now he's got it. And they start again. And then he played. And he played well enough so that with the symphony orchestra kind of covering and leading, he sounded like a tremendous violin virtuoso. So, yes. You see what you can do with a yes? You get an hour out of it.
How old were you when you started writing? Do
you remember Duke or know anything about him?
No.
No, the only reason I asked you is because... Oh, let's see. I was about 25, I think. 24. 23, I don't know. The reason for the change? Bill Morrow was drafted into the Army. Eddie Boulogne wanted to move on to pictures. They were with Jack about 5 years, I believe. And then in replacing them, instead of only taking two, Jack decided to go to four. And with Sam Perrin, my partner, we had worked together for a couple of years on Burns and Allen and on the Tommy Riggs Betty Lou show. So then when the call came from Jack, why, we moved over as a team. And it just never finished, which was good. Most writers at that time would work on a 13-week assignment, maybe 26. If you're lucky, you got a year. If you were extremely lucky, you got 2 years. Then the show would either be gone or you'd be gone or whatever. But ours went on for 25. And today they can't get a job. But anyway,
thank you very much for being our guest today. And please feel free to come back anytime.
All right, thank you.